So I'm going to talk about our efforts to come up with theoretical explanations for the distributed practice effect. That's just a fancier name for the spacing effect. Just to remind everyone of the basic paradigm, the experimental work that's done usually involves subjects trying to learn some paired associates or facts. They have two study opportunities, and then there's a test later on in time. The horizontal axis is time here. The time between the first study and the second study is called the inter-study interval, or ISI, and the time between the second study and the test is called the retention interval, or RI. And the basic spacing or distributed practice effect is that as you increase the ISI, keeping the RI constant, performance improves. And I'll show you some curves from human data in a bit. There's a rich theoretical literature that tries to explain this effect. I'm going to tell you about two different classes of theories and also two particular models that fall within those classes. If you recognize the name Stadden, he's been one of our site visitors on two occasions, and he asked a question about whether we were thinking about his model, and it turns out to be one of the more interesting models. So next time he comes as a site visitor, we can all refer to details. But what I'm going to tell you about is how you can take these two different theories, each of which is inadequate, put them together and come up with a cool story about temporal dynamics and memory. So let me start with encoding variability theories. The idea here is that each time you study some material, a separate trace is laid down. That trace obviously contains information about the material you're learning, but also a psychological context. What does that mean? That means sort of how you're feeling that day and what the temperature is and other things you've been thinking about in recently. Am I okay? Okay. And this context, let's just think about it as an abstract thing that I'm representing on the vertical axis here, wanders over time. This explains forgetting in the following way. Suppose you study an item at some time S, and then during a retention interval, the context wanders. Then you're tested at some time T. The success of retrieval will depend on similarity of the contexts at study and at test. And the more time that passes between study and test, the less similar you'd expect the context to be if the context is wandering randomly, if it's a diffusion process. It also explains the distributed practice effect qualitatively. And let me give you a story about that. So here we're going to have an opportunity to study an item at S1. Some time passes, an opportunity at S2. Some more time passes, the retention interval. You're tested at T. And success at T depends on whether you're able to recall either of these two traces. So it depends on the similarity of T to either S2 or S1's context. And you can see that if S1 and S2 are close together, the contexts are going to be very similar. And so the context at T won't have as many opportunities to have a match with either of these contexts. If you allow there to be more time between S1 and S2, then the context has more opportunity at test to be similar to one of the two. There's less redundancy. A particular model that instantiates this encoding variability idea is by Jeroen Rademakers. Does anyone know if I'm saying his name right? I always ask people that.
It's
Rademakers, thank you. In which case, in his model, he has the context represented by a pool of binary-valued neurons. I should say, if you know this model, the description of the model won't sound anything like this. This is my interpretation that kind of casts it in a neural network framework that makes it a little bit more concrete. So think about a bunch of neurons, and hopefully they're going to be neurons in the dentate gyrus. That would be really cool if we could spin this story with Janet. And these neurons flip on and off. And so green is on, red is off. And in order to learn an item, there's going to be a set of neurons that represent things you're learning. And those are output neurons. These are input neurons. And there's a Hebbian learning rule, which means when you study something, study an item, you associate the item to be learned with any context bits that are on. Then at test, the context has changed because these bits flip on and off. And you just compute the activity of this output unit, and that determines the recall probability. And that will, in turn, depend on the similarity of the study context and the test context, because we've strengthened the associations for the neurons that were on during study. And if the same neurons are on during test, we'll get lots of activity for the output. Make sense? In the case where you have several study opportunities, you can see if the two study contexts are dissimilar, you'll strengthen different subsets of the connections, and so at test, there'll be more opportunities, more connections that are strengthened, and so there'll be more overlap between the test context and combined study one, study two context that produces more robust recall. And that explains why, if the two study contexts are dissimilar, you should get a benefit for recall. Here's a more, one slide with equations. I promise this is the only one. But there's an important concept that I have to get across here. So retrieval at test is facilitated when the context units active at test were also active during study. And so what we really care about is what's the probability that the context at study had value 1, it was a green, and the context at test had value 1, because that's going to be related to the probability of retrieval. So if the contexts are very similar, this joint probability will be large. Now, in order to compute this probability, we have to specify how this context wanders over time. And so we have context neurons, or bits, that flip off to on at a certain rate. Mu is just a rate parameter. Mu 0, 1 is off to on. And then they can flip from on to off at another rate. And given this bit flipping, you can compute the probability that both of these context bits will be on at study and at test. And what it boils down to, don't worry about the equation, is that you get an exponential forgetting function. That is, as you increase the time from study to test, the similarity of the context will decrease, and decrease exponentially so. And so the probability of recall on the vertical axis here will drop exponentially. That turns out to be a lousy forgetting function, because human forgetting functions follow a power law, and the purple curve here is a power law. They look kind of similar here, don't they? But when you plot them on a log-log scale, they look very, very different. And an important property of the power law is that it shows scale invariance. That is, the memory has the same property at different time scales, and that corresponds to this sort of straight line over many orders of magnitude of retention interval. Is it a problem that Reimacher's model doesn't show scale invariance? Well, yes, it turns out distributed practice affects scale or scale invariant, and I'll show you this in data in a little bit. And the model, though, has other problems too. It has a whole bunch of free parameters and ugly hacks, and it doesn't really fit the data that well. So let's move on to a different class of theories, which I'll give the name predictive utility theories. And the idea here is we're going to start with the assumption that memory is capacity limited and or memory is imperfect, and you can get intrusions if there's too much stuff stored in memory when you're trying to do retrieval. In order to achieve optimal performance under this condition, you should erase memories if they're not likely to be needed in the future. So let me give you an example here of two scenarios, the red scenario and the green scenario. The red scenario involves events that occur at a fairly high rate, green scenario at a much slower rate. And then I ask, what happens if you're tested at this time? And so in the red case, you'll have seen this constant stream of red things, like, you know, bush, 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 and then suddenly you don't hear about Bush anymore. And then you're tested, and maybe you've forgotten about him at this point, because you can argue on the basis of predictive utility, if you've been hearing about this concept many times, and then suddenly you don't hear about it, it's no longer needed. Whereas in the green stream, you'd expect retrieval for the green item or the recollection of the green to be strong, because this time follows with the event occurrence rate. So the idea is you throw away information you don't need if you're not expecting to see it again, and that's based on this prediction of when information will be needed again. So here's where John Staden's model comes in. He studies rats, and if you habituate rats, I don't remember the details of the experiment, like just imagine you're prodding the rat over and over again with some stimulus, the rat will habituate to a repeated stream of stimuli, that is, it will stop, you know, flinching or biting you or whatever it does. And the time it takes for the rat to recover from habituation depends on the rate of stimuli. So if the stimuli are occurring at a fast rate, and this curve is supposed to reflect something like the recovery from habituation, how strong a response the rat will give if at this time the stimulus is applied again, you get a faster recovery for high-rate stimuli than for slow-rate stimuli. So that's an empirical finding. And they built a model to explain this. And they did this by claiming that each item you're trying to learn is represented by a memory consisting of leaky integrators at multiple timescales. So the vertical red bars here are the times at which stimuli are presented. And these are leaky integrators that decay either at a very short time scale or slow time scale, fast and slow time scales. And the idea is that your memory for the item to be learned is the sum of these integrator activities across time scales. So there's a multi-scale representation. And the key idea that makes this all work is a memory storage rule that says integrators with long time constants, off on the right here, get activated only when the integrators with the short time constants have decayed. And there's a mathematical formulation of that I won't bore you with. It's a cascaded error correction rule. So here's an example from his paper. We have 10 integrators splayed along the x-axis here, and we have their activity on the y-axis, and this is the activity after repeatedly presenting stimuli over and over again at different ISIs, at a short ISI, medium ISIs, and a very long ISI. And what you see is, at the short ISI, only the fast-decaying integrators are active. At the long ISI, the slow-decaying integrators become active. And so the memory becomes more durable in this case than in this case. And then if you add together the activity of these integrators as a function of time from the very last stimulus, this gives you a forgetting function. And you can see that the forgetting function is much slower in the case of spaced stimuli than massed stimuli. Make sense? Okay, so this model was fit to rat habituation and interval timing data. They made some claims that, oh yeah, this explains spacing effects, but it really isn't specified well enough to explain human studies of distributed practice. So at this point, we identified the fact that these two models share a key property, which is exponential decay. And there's some other properties, but this is the one that I can show you graphically. So in the encoding variability model, in Reimacher's model, this happens via context drift over time. In the predictive utility model, this happens via these leaky integrators. And we can identify the components of the two models that have this exponential decay and merge the two models. So we're going to combine the multiple timescale representation of Staden's model with the contextual drift of Reimacher's model. And that gives us what we call the multi-scale context model, or MCM, which happens to be my initials. So here's the idea. We have a now not just one pool of context neurons, but n pools of context neurons. In a particular pool P, all neurons flip at a certain rate, alpha, indexed by that pool size. So these neurons will flip quickly, these will flip more slowly. And the pools can also be different sizes, and the relative proportion of units in pool P is going to be gamma of P. That produces a retrieval function, which is a mixture of exponentials. So we have some fast-decaying things, some slower-decaying things. When you add up a bunch of exponentials, you get something that very well approximates both human forgetting functions and power laws. So in principle, this can characterize human forgetting in a more sensible way than just a single pool, which has an exponential decay. Now, there's a lot of free parameters in this model because there's an alpha for each pool and a gamma for each pool. And so to simplify the model, I came up with a proposal for how to specify alpha and gamma as a function of pools. And this graphic sort of shows you this. I've just sort of arrayed the pools from 1 to 50 and made a rule that says the alpha, the rate of flipping, is high in the early pools and low in the late pools, and it falls off exponentially. And the relative proportion of neurons in each pool is high in the fast-flipping pool and small in the slow-flipping pool. That produces four parameters that characterize these distributions. And then the game is going to be to say, can we select these parameters such that the resulting model both yields a power law forgetting function and gets good fits to the human data? So here's from an experiment that Hal's postdoc Nicholas ran. If we look at retention interval, and recall probability. The red points here are human data. So, sorry, I didn't explain this. Single study opportunity, followed by a retention interval, followed by a test. And we just look at, this is what I would call a basic forgetting function. And I plotted this on a log-log scale. And so a power law has a sort of flat region here followed by a steep fall off, the particular form of the power law, which has a constant added to it before you exponentiate it. The red points are human data, and the green points are a model fit with this multi-scale context model. So it's able to capture this forgetting function. Here's another forgetting function from a different part of Nicholas's experiment. Here's a couple power laws I made up. This is just some arbitrary power law. Again, nice fit. So kind of cool thing that this parameterized form of these pool size and rate parameters will give us nice power law fits, and not only power law fits, but this sort of funny form that seems to correspond to human forgetting functions where you have a constant plus time. So let me just kind of summarize where we're at before I show you the cool results. I may be done early. Make up for Gary's sloth. What we've done is to take the context drift idea from Reimacher's, the multiple time scale representation from Staden, and I didn't tell you about this, but learning rules from both of the two models. In the Reimacher's model, how well you learn on a particular study trial depends on whether you successfully retrieved from your previous study, and the Staden model, which has this cascaded or error correction learning that only learns on a slower time scale if it has a lot of error in its prediction on the fast time scale. And then we've added a couple of things. We've added this idea that pools vary in size, which I needed to get these power law forgetting functions, and that we have the simple parameterization of multi-scale constants, and I have a whole story about how this can be cast as a neural network. So here's some data from the study that I showed you the forgetting functions for, that Nicholas, is it? Yeah, it's a study. In this study, they varied the ISI from, I think, 1 day to 168 days. And the blue curve is the probability of recall at study two. So you've studied the first time, an ISI follows, you test them at the beginning of the second study session, so you can assess recall. This is a sort of generic forgetting function, another generic function. These are for two different tasks, picture learning, fact learning. Fact learning's a little harder. You can see with an ISI of 168 days, recall performance is down to, I don't know, less than 10%, whereas here it's up at 20%. So two different materials, same task. And then after the second study, there's 168 days that go past, and then there's a final test, and so that 168-day retention interval, which explains why Hal doesn't have new data to show us every few weeks, because it takes a year or so to run these studies. And then this black curve is the spacing function. So as you vary the ISI, keeping RI constant at 168 days, increasing the ISI produces a whopping effect, right? You go from sort of a one-day interstudy interval of 20-something percent, 25%, up to 55% with a 28-day ISI, and then it drops off. So this sort of peak and drop-off is very characteristic of spacing function. It peaks and drops off. It usually drops off. The drop-off is far shallower than the rise. So this is the human data. Then what we've done is our model has four parameters. We fit the blue forgetting functions to the model, constrain the four parameters of the model. Then the model's fully constrained, and we can make a prediction for what the spacing function will be. So this is what we get out of the model. It's not going to get, it's not going to nail this exactly. I'm not too disturbed that this is, wrong by a factor almost of two somewhere at some points. But it's gotten the right characteristic, and the interesting thing is the human data suggests the peak is at 28 days for both sets of materials. The model says that the optimal spacing depends very much on the materials and the forgetting rate, which intuitively that makes sense, and the model actually predicts very different peak interstudy intervals. So this one is longer than 28 days, and this one's shorter than 28 days, but both are consistent with the data points that they were able to collect in this experiment. I sent Hal and Nicholas an email saying, why don't you run this with sort of ISIs of 1 day apart? Nicholas just got really upset. So we can get something else out of the model for free, which is we can look at the probability of recall at test conditional on successful recall at study 2 versus probability of recall at test in red, given you weren't successfully recalling at study 2. Model gets it more or less qualitatively right. Here's a second experiment. In this experiment, the ISI was varied from 0 to 100 days, and then four RIs were used for the same material, 7, 35, 70, and 350 days. The blue curves should all be the same. They're a little bit different because they're different populations of subjects, but it's the same materials. So these are the basic forgetting functions on the second study. And then the black curves are the spacing functions, and what you see is for an RI of 7 days, a very short ISI is optimal. For 35, it looks like, I don't know, it's 5 or 10 days. For 70 days, it looks like the optimal ISI is closer to 20 days. And then for 350-day RI, the optimal ISI may be somewhere out here, 40 or 50 days. So as the retention interval increases for the same material, the optimal ISI also increases. So here's the model's fit. Again, fitting the four free parameters of the model to the blue curve, and then the black curves are completely emergent predictions from the model. And you can see that the model's captured here. It likes a very short ISI, longer, longer, and longer still. So the model's really, I'm very pleased with these results. And for people who aren't modelers, you're like, oh no, I can see a difference between the two curves. But, you know, you should just shut up and be happy. Here is, again, conditioned on correct and incorrect recall at study 2. So just to show you, there's sort of more emergent data points here that come out of the model. We can also model all the standard effects in the literature, all the standard experiments in the literature. Like there's a famous study by Art Glenberg from the 1960s. It's not too interesting to do that, but I fit the four free parameters of the model, and I get fits that are at least as good as the fits of other existing models that have on the order of 15 parameters. And when you email the authors and ask them a question, they say, oh, well, there were also these other parameters I didn't tell you about. And finally, here's the coup de grace, if that's proper French. Looking at the relationship between the retention interval and the optimal ISI. This is from a meta-analysis that Nicholas and Hal did. And each purple dot here is one experimental study where there was a certain retention interval for some material in that study. And the study involved a number of different ISIs, and to the extent Nicholas could, he identified which ISI was optimal. But the values along here are very noisy because in an experiment, you can only afford to run four or five ISIs, so don't pay too much attention to the noise on here. And this is plotted in log-log coordinates, and you get roughly a power law relationship. That's what the straight line reflects. And so this is arguing for the scale invariance, temporal scale invariance of the spacing effect. So now I took our model, the multiscale context model, randomly picked parameters over a large range, and just ran the model over and over again. So there's no free parameters here. I'm just sort of picking parameters randomly, picking RIs randomly, looking at the optimal ISI for a particular RI, then computed the median value. There's always some spread because the exact optimal ISI will depend on the materials. And this just came out, bam! Could that be any cooler? So there's another model by Phil Pavlik and John Anderson that's sort of based on ACT-R. And their model has enough free parameters that I can make it have any slope I want to. But this model is fully constrained. So why are we proposing yet another model? These previous models have many free parameters, and all of them only obtain post hoc fits to data. And our goal here is to develop a truly predictive model that has few free parameters, where the parameters are fully constrained by the forgetting function, and that given this forgetting function, you can predict the optimal distribution of practice. Let me tell you, in the 20 seconds I have left, the things we're currently working on. The first thing is that these experimental studies that have been done up until now all involve two study sessions, and now Hal has moved on to the more advanced stage of looking at three study sessions with Sean Kang, a postdoc who's probably here. Is Sean here? Ah, there's Sean. I haven't actually met Sean yet. We've been talking on the phone and email. And Hal and my grad student, Rob Lindsay, have designed an experiment where they're looking at decreasing, equal, and increasing spacing of practice. And so that's either underway or about to begin. Yay, Sean's nodding. And then Rob and I are comparing predictions of two different models, the MCM, the model I've been telling you about, and this Pavlik and Anderson model. It turns out the Pavlik and Anderson model predicts pretty robustly that decreasing spacing is best. And the "it turns out" means that Rob spent a whole semester emailing back and forth with Phil Pavlik trying to figure out what the hell his model was actually doing. And my intuition is that's going to be wrong. But the MCM generally predicts equal spacing, but it depends on the specific materials. You can get increasing or decreasing spacing is optimal. Hal is exploring distributed practice effects with more complex materials, legal and scientific reasoning. And a final project that Hal suggested to us in Colorado is another project with more complex materials that my grad student Hajar Homei, who some of you may have met in the last couple years, is developing a Facebook app with Rob Lindsay to learn not the sort of trivial facts you usually teach people in these experiments, but important facts, survival tactics. So questions like, you know, if you're in an earthquake in a building, where should you stand? I guess it's in the doorway. So Hajar's been off the last semester developing a natural language interface to allow subjects of Facebook on Facebook to type in natural language responses. And the hope is to make this interesting and useful enough that there'll be this large population of free subjects, basically, in a fairly uncontrolled environment where we can do this in two modes. One is just sort of let subjects study this material whenever they want to, so they'll specify the spacing, but we'll collect enough data from enough subjects that we'll be able to get the sort of manipulations you can't get, or the amount of data you can't get in an ordinary experiment. But the other thing we can do is once we feel like we have a handle on the material and what the forgetting function is, we can use the model to dynamically optimize study session spacing. So we can send the subjects a reminder saying, hey, you should study this material now if you want to optimize your long-term retention. And then we can run experiments by either looking at subjects who followed our guidance versus subjects who didn't. I guess that puts a bias in the subject population. Maybe that's not a good idea. All right, well, I'll talk to someone who knows more about experimental design. I'm good, thank you. Terry.
Could the next speaker start to connect up while Mike answers questions?
So how does your model take into account different study materials?
Just by the nature of the forgetting function. So it doesn't know anything about the materials per se. It's just that some materials that are harder to retain are forgotten faster. So, Paula. It doesn't. And it's an open question, and I guess Tim will have more to say about this, whether the two are the same or different. Hal has some opinions about that, I know. So.
The way I look at it is you're talking about trying to figure out the optimal time
of
booster shots for learning.
Yeah, so another interesting thing that the model lets us do, Paula said the model lets you figure out optimal booster shots, is rather than thinking about you want to retain material for some particular instant in time when you're going to be tested, is you have some distribution over time at which you'll need the material in the future. And so the model can optimize for that distribution, not for a particular RI, which is the obviously real-world useful thing. Javier. Yeah, so what's the computational level theory? Yeah. I don't. Usually that's where I start with models, but this is a more mechanism-focused thing.
Well, it's kind of qualitatively consistent with the idea that the frequency with which items occurred is inversely related to sort of its expected need.
Yeah.
Like
that. Yeah, that's fair. To the extent it fits into this predictive utility kind of framework, then that's a computational level theory. The encoding variability, why do you want to store context? Well, maybe it's only to keep track of time, which I think is the idea in Janet's work in her dentate gyrus modeling. I should probably stop.